Hey, this is Gavin Jackson, host of the South Carolina Lead, welcoming you to our first live podcast taping episode. We made this episode very unique, which is why it's a little bit longer than normal. We taped it in front of a crowd of about 50-plus leaders at Growler House in Greenville last Thursday. But don't worry if you missed it, because we have more events planned, so be sure to stay tuned for that. Also, just want to let you know that we'll have a recap of Tuesday's election results, so be sure to check out our mini-episode that will drop on Wednesday this week. So, without further ado, I present to you the South Carolina Lead. Welcome to the South Carolina Lead, a podcast that breaks down state political news for you and provides insight on legislative happenings under the Statehouse Dome in Columbia. Hello, I'm your host, Gavin Jackson, and this episode is for the week of November 6, 2018. Happy Election Day! But while it's Election Day, we are in, Greenville for our first live taping, and we're talking all things midterm elections with two of our top lead guests. This is our final look at the governor's race, several congressional races, and other issues on the ballot. Also, we're going to drop a short episode on Wednesday recapping all the election results, so stay tuned for that. The Lead is a podcast where we go behind the headlines with the reporters who wrote the stories affecting you. Every Tuesday, we give you a roundup of news, insight into the week's biggest stories, campaign trail intrigue, and a chaser of trivia. You can listen to all four sections while you wait in line to vote. Just don't wear your candidate's buttons, Brenda. Or while you recover from midterm madness, while blaring Christmas music and putting up your Christmas tree, because it's already November.
Merry Christmas!
And now for our brief quorum call. Quorum call is a term to see if there's a majority present, but here on the South Carolina Lead, we know a majority of the time that you're not always current with the news. So here's a quick recap of several top stories you should know about. Number one, boondoggle update. The Associated Press reported that SCNG said regulators should bear much of the responsibility for the two failed nuclear reactors at VC Summer that cost customers billions of dollars. In his opening statement before the Public Service Commission, SCNG lawyer David Balser blamed the Office of Regulatory Staff for poor oversight of the project. The agency says it was lied to and a law passed a decade ago tied its hands, requiring it to lean toward utilities instead of customers. It will likely be weeks of hearings before the Public Service Commission determines who will pay for SCANA's 55% share of the project. Number two, double boondoggle update. The Post and Courier reported that Dominion Energy is willing to own and run parts of the state-owned power company Santee Cooper, but it's still not interested in buying the utility outright. The proposal from Dominion throws yet another curveball into an already tangled battle over the future of South Carolina's energy sector, which has been in turmoil since the $9 billion nuclear project was called off last year. Santee Cooper racked up $4 billion in debt to pay for its share of the nuclear project at VC Summer. Dominion was scant on the details of the proposal. Number three, the Post and Courier reported that a vast majority of South Carolinians believe in global warming. This insight came by way of a new poll released by Winthrop University. 48% believe that climate change is equally caused by human activity and natural forces, while 28% of respondents said humans were mostly to blame. But the state is close to evenly split on whether exploration of gas and oil should go forward off the coast, with 47% in support and 42% opposed. And we only had three quorum call items because we want to spend as much time on our discussion. But just like that, and everyone's skipping Thanksgiving for Christmas, we buried the lead. Well, it's the day we've all been looking forward to for more than a year, some more than that, I'm sure. Election Day. Say it with me now. Election Day. Yes, this podcast drops on Election Day, but we're here to recap the races that we'll be watching as we huddle over our computers, cramped on the risers and the media pits on election night. Here to discuss the races with me is Jamie Lovegrove with the Post and Courier and Meg Kennard with the Associated Press. Thank you both for coming to Greenville for us and turning out today.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely.
Thank you to the crowd. It's a great crowd. So looking at the historical data, Meg, I want to talk to you. Look at the historical data that we have in the state. Obviously, South Carolina is very red in present circumstances. Is there anything that we can expect, any surprises that maybe the AP you guys are planning for or expect to see come Election Day when it comes to turnout or even results?
We've already decided all the winners, so it's really a foregone conclusion. No, seriously. We often hear this, but in years like this, especially in midterm elections, it is very, very true. It all comes down to turnout. It depends on how energized, how excited the different sides have gotten their base voters. You're right that here, generally, and certainly all of our statewide offices are occupied by Republicans. Governor McMaster has made a strong campaign to win his first full term in office. So Republicans are out there. They're campaigning very hard. On the other side of things, Democrats are doing the very same thing. They've got candidates active in all of the congressional races, in most of the statewide races, and certainly in the governor's race. So it is a lot of it is going to come down to turnout, as it often does in a midterm election year. That can be harder to predict, harder to figure out. Who cares? There's no president to vote for. Mm-hmm. There's no Senate race here in South Carolina to vote for. So that is going to be something that we're watching very carefully. And we can start looking at early voting, mm-hmm. Early in-person absentee, which we have here in South Carolina. Some of those numbers are available. So that right now is pretty much our only indicator.
And Jamie, you were hanging out with the Smith campaign last week. They got their tour bus. McMaster has his tour bus. Mm-hmm. What's the momentum like on both sides of the camp? I mean, is McMaster kind of riding a great wave? We saw in that Winthrop poll that he does have a lot of support. He has a great approval rating right now. James Smith obviously is facing somewhat of an uphill battle. What's the momentum like out there in the field from people, what you've been seeing?
You know, both sides are very energized at this point. As we've seen nationwide this year, and for the last 2 years, really, Democrats have been very excited to get to November 6th. They have been counting down the days. And, you know, based on all of the election analysts and prognosticators at this point, it seems very likely that Democrats are going to take back the House majority. You know, when it comes to a state like South Carolina, of course, Democrats are always going to face an uphill battle. And the challenge for Smith is the challenge that a lot of Democrats face when they're running in a statewide level in South Carolina, which is he's trying to do two things. He's trying to narrow the gap in places like right here in Greenville and in the upstate. Donald Trump had a 25% victory in Greenville County in 2016. He had a 30% victory in Spartanburg County. If you can get that down to 10 to 15%, it can be a whole different ballgame. Mm-hmm. At the same time, while you're spending a lot of time up here, you absolutely still have to be energizing the base. You have to be going and energizing African-American supporters. You have to be going to Orangeburg. You have to be going to places where Democrats have traditionally, you know, relied on very strong turnout. So you're trying to do both those things at the same time. That's pretty difficult. You can't be in two places at once. As a result, you spend a lot of time traveling here towards the end and really trying to both, you know, bring this message across to potentially winnable swing voters, winnable moderate Republicans, while also making sure that you know, Democratic-based voters are energized and come to the polls in record numbers.
Meg, I was talking to Scott Huffman, professor at Winthrop University, who did the Winthrop poll on This Week in South Carolina. It's our show that comes on ETV at 7:30 on Fridays. That's a little shameless cross-promotion, but same company. So what I was wondering, though, is that we were talking about historical data. We were looking at the Vincent Shaheen race 2010 versus Nikki Haley. That was a 4% race right there. Different story in 2014 when it was, I think, about 15 percentage points. Are we going to be somewhere in between that, you think? I mean, I'm not asking for you to tell me what's going to happen, but obviously different situations, different incumbencies at that point. Is McMaster enough of an incumbent where it's kind of going to be like 2014? He did say that Smith was a better challenger than Shaheen, so, and of course, he's not facing John Warren, which would have been a completely different story.
That's what I've heard from a lot of people across the state, folks who've been looking at these races closely for the last couple of cycles, as we have, that for Democrats to have success in the governor's race this year, they have felt and continue to feel that James Smith is their best bet. He has conservative creds in the legislature. He is not to the far left of his party. He has leadership capability as well, but they also see him as someone who could be reaching out and be appealing to those unicorns of voters, the people in the middle, those moderates.
Well, and it's interesting, too, just to interrupt you, that I was looking over the debate transcripts, and I didn't see Donald Trump's name very often
at all. Very interesting.
Those. I mean, yeah. A lot different than the primary.
That's obviously. Right. In the primary, you're right. We heard a lot of that. We heard a lot of, on all sides, from a lot of the Republican candidates, Donald Trump's name came up a lot. That's not something that we heard in the general election. So, you know, getting back to James Smith, he does have a lot of things about his candidacy that could appeal to some Republicans, and he's made no bones about it. He's told me, he's told Jamie in interviews too, you know, I know that I need Republicans to vote for me. I know that I'm going to have to get some of those folks to come over and to cross that party line. So he is very well aware of that.
You know, speaking of that, right before I came in here today, the Smith campaign sent out a fundraising email, and the subject line, I thought, so it was 10 words long, and it so captured exactly the message that he is trying to drive home, a twofold message, both that bipartisan crossover message and also what he emphasizes all the time, that he's a combat veteran who enlisted after 9/11. Mm-hmm. And the subject line was, on the battlefield, no one cared about my political party. And that's really going to be the message that he's trying to drive home over these last few days. We saw him yesterday or the other day release an endorsement from Hunter Limbaugh, who is a former very conservative state legislator. You know, he has been emphasizing the fact that Republicans can support him for a very long time. And again, it's going to be about balancing winning over those folks without alienating any progressive voters. Mm-hmm.
And I know we're about 7 minutes into this part of the discussion. We have a lot of other races to talk about, but yeah. A big takeaway, a lot of for national stories as well, is that, you know, this race, you know, in state houses across the country and governor's mansions across the country is going to be key to, again, the redistricting in 2020 after the 2020 census. We haven't really seen too much coverage about that, but Meg, do you want to talk about possibly the ramifications of what this race has on redistricting efforts in South Carolina in the future?
Sure. I mean, you talk to pretty much anybody who's involved at a congressional level or any of these districts, and they do talk about that control factor, how districts look very different than they did 10, 20 years ago, having been redrawn depending on who's in charge. If we do see Democrats come into control in the House, I would imagine that there will be a very active campaign to try to get some of these districts back to, I don't want to say back to baseline because I'm not in charge of this, but perhaps back to something that some sides would see as a little bit more representative of not just one party or the other. It could swing completely the other direction. We could see Democrats take that very seriously if they do come into control. But you're absolutely right. That is something that nobody has really been talking about in depth a lot. But it's one of those things that depending on who's in charge of the House, that is a very big thing that will be on their plate.
No, I mean, as we know, you know, speaking about just being representative, you know, Republicans have 6 congressional seats in the state and Democrats have 1. That's a pretty far difference between what we see in the statewide voting totals. Mm-hmm. You know, Republicans win 55-60%, maybe a little more in good years, but 6-1 is not close. It's the same in the state House. It's the same in state Senate. So, you know, that's how a lot of political scientists look at it. And, you know, the redistricting process for anyone who has ever been anywhere close to it, even when you have one party in charge of both the governor's mansion and the state house, it is a very, very contentious process. Mm-hmm. If James Smith were to win this race, it would be a very interesting next couple of years after the census.
Well, and in the state house, they're also trying to push through to get an independent commission and to really try and make this as least partisan as possible, but of course, you know,
it's always hard to
we'll
take
see
away.
What happens
it,
in
it's
January.
Very, 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 very hard to convince the legislature to take away power from the legislature.
Oh, you want to talk about ethics reform really quick? switching gears, we're going to talk about the first congressional district. Cook Political Reports has the first congressional district as lean Republican, which means it's considered competitive, but Republicans have the advantage there. State Rep. Katie Arrington won the nomination outright in June with 51% of the vote to Sanford, 47% of the vote. She faces Democrat Joe Cunningham. Jamie, I know you guys have been covering this race a lot.
Yeah.
Could this be one race that Democrats maybe take? I mean, I know the House is looking really, you know, it's really likely that the House is going to switch with the 23 votes they need. But we were talking to Scott again about this, and he said if something like this happened, it would be grave in a sense. Are Democrats thinking that could happen? Are Republicans worried that's going to happen?
Well, I can answer both those questions.
That's why I invited you here.
You know, so sort of some of the big insider news that we saw earlier this week initially was that the National Republican Congressional Committee, the NRCC, was going to start spending what they said they were going to start spending, $87,000 on ads in the first congressional district down in the Lowcountry. And they did put out an ad, and they started running it. And last night, I was checking their FEC filings, and it turned out they were actually spending $228,000 on that ad.
Can we just mention you were checking the FEC filings? This is what we do. This is not
like,
you know,
my hobby.
Exciting.
That's what I do for fun.
That's why you get. I mean, that's
when
what
I get
it
home
is.
At night. So. Whether or not Republicans are worried, I think there's absolutely no question they are. I hear it all the time from Republican strategists about this district. You know, we have seen internal polls that suggest that it is at most a 1 to 2 point race at this point. Some of those polls are tied. This is a district that Sanford won quite easily for many years. It is a district that, while the Cook Political Report now says it's lean Republican, what they're referring to there is not the district, mm-hmm. it's the race. Mm-hmm. Historically, this district is safe Republican. Yeah. It is not lean Republican. It's an R-plus 10 district.
The last close race was 2008, and
right.
That was, you know, a lot has changed since then.
You know, Elizabeth Colbert Bush gave it a good run in 2013, but, so it has been fascinating to watch. You know, you maybe could have predicted that it would be close, you know, after Katie Arrington won that Republican primary. Of course, she kind of ran on this very pro-Trump message, mm-hmm. Which was very successful in Republican primaries all over the country this year. But of course, there are going to be some Republicans and moderate voters and independents who are not going to be as attuned to that message,
and
it's given an opening to them.
This district isn't what one would consider a super strong Trump district.
No.
So to be using that message in a general election, as Governor McMaster is seeing in dealing with that in his own general election in South Carolina, it's not a given at
all. Hillary Clinton won Charleston County. Marco Rubio won Charleston County in the primary. This is one of those districts that is not, I mean, Horry, you know, that's
Buford's
a very...
a little bit more of a stronghold
exactly,
there.
Exactly, right.
But Charleston is its own thing.
Oh, yeah. But Meg, looking at Sanford not endorsing Arrington, does that signal something to Sanford allies and dedicated voters down there? I mean, is there going to be a lack of enthusiasm maybe that projects?
Sure, it signals that Mark Sanford is still Mark Sanford. if he had done something predictable, I feel like we would be wondering what happened to him.
We'd be holding that down.
Did he bump his head?
Did he plan to lose this race?
I don't know that it's a secret message, to use your verbiage that you like to do. I don't know that it's a secret message to Trump, to Mark Sanford supporters throughout the district, but it is something that's significant because this is the first race that he had ever lost in his entire political career, governor, Congress, all of that good stuff. So, you know, to see him not to weigh in, you know, there are some places we might expect that. We might expect to see some Republican unity for a general election. We certainly saw that on behalf of some of Governor McMaster's challengers backing him after the primary and runoff
were over. But they backed him.
He's not even coming close to it. But again, I've known Mark Sanford since I showed up in South Carolina 13 years ago, and this doesn't surprise me at all that he would choose to do this.
And I just want to emphasize something about this district, which is this was not at all one of the districts that people were looking at on the map of saying Democrats need to win this district, take back the House.
Right.
There are 60 plus more competitive districts, many of them Republican held around the country in this midterm. You know, when people were looking at this race early on, and I think this holds true today, this is a race that if Democrats win, you know, we really are talking about blue wave, if not bigger. I mean, this is, you're talking about 25, 30 seat majorities.
Something much
at that
larger
point
is going to have happened on that night if the first.
So that would be a big sign. It would be a big sign.
But that blue wave in South Carolina is just going to be a little bit on the shores there, if anywhere in South Carolina, beyond that first congressional district.
Just to clarify. And I think, you know, David Slade, one of our business reporters, actually had and he covers the census a lot. He had a really great story this morning about the demographics in that district. You know, a lot of folks in that district have moved there over the last 5 to 10 years, if not, you know, more recently. It's the wealthiest congressional district in the state. It is the most educated congressional district in the state, and those can at times be the types of characteristics voters, yeah. that you know, folks moving into South Carolina, transplants, that can create more fertile ground for Democrats.
And really quick, we want to switch up to the 5th congressional district here, yeah. too. A lot happened this week in this 5th congressional district, and I know, Jamie, you covered a good bit about it. Just go ahead and launch into it, because I don't want to bother explaining for you. Just go for you and explain it, dealing with the Archie Parnell situation, Jim Clyburn.
Okay, so for those who have not been
glued to the news
or paying attention to this story, because it is pretty inside baseball at the end of the day, you know, so Congressman Clyburn was scheduled to attend a fish fry in Sumter on Election Eve, Monday night, at which Archie Parnell, the Democratic congressional candidate, was also scheduled to attend.
The whole thing announced by Archie Parnell's campaign.
It was very much announced by the Archie Parnell campaign, who advertised it as Congressman Clyburn is joining Archie Parnell at this event.
And Archie Parnell had, you know, obviously...
Anyone who was not paying attention to Archie Parnell, in May, I obtained divorce records from Archie Parnell's first marriage in the 1970s years, yeah. that showed that he had beaten his wife on one night, had broken into her friend's apartment with a tire iron and beaten her again. The Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee called on him to drop out of the race. The state South Carolina Democratic Party chairman, Trav Robertson, called him to drop out of the race. Most of his staff quit. He had not told his staff about these graphic details in his divorce records. Congressman Clyburn, who had been a huge supporter of Archie Parnell's. I think that can't be emphasized enough. Early mentor of his, helped him in the special election in 2017, which he very surprisingly narrowly lost by 3 points. He also urged him to drop out. Whatever we'll say at this point, he definitely urged him to drop out. He ended up winning the primary. This happened a few weeks before the primary. His competition was, he had 3 other competitors, but they were not particularly strong candidates. He won easily. He got 60%+ of the vote. He, of course, argued that was a mandate for him and that it showed that the voters didn't care. And he has rebuilt some of his campaign apparatus. He's hired more staff. And some folks, 11 of the 12 Democratic county chairs in that district now support him. There are several members of the state legislature, John King, Gilda Cobb Hunter, who have come out publicly and supported him. So it's been a very interesting race to track. Definitely. You know, most folks no longer really view that district as competitive. It was seen as a competitive race at the beginning. But it was always going to be a stretch for Democrats, even if they had run a perfect campaign.
Yeah, and then that 3%, that special election, I mean, it was a special
it's
election.
A special
right,
election.
It was a special election. Anyway, so we fast forward to this week. This was announced. Congressman Clyburn didn't really comment on it on the first day, but Archie Parnell was very much advertising this as Congressman Clyburn was going to join him. I started getting a lot of text messages and phone calls from very, very close supporters and allies of Congressman Clyburn, who folks may have noticed is potentially the next Speaker of the House. Things have to fall in place. You know, Nancy Pelosi would have to not be able to muster enough support, but he has said publicly, if she's not able to get enough votes in the Democratic caucus, I would be interested in being Speaker of the
and
House.
And he's been in Democratic
he's
House
been in
leadership
Democratic
for,
House
a very
leadership for a long time.
Time.
He's currently the 3rd ranking House Democrat. He's beloved by the Congressional Black Caucus, which is a very important voting bloc within the Democratic Party in Congress. Anyway, so, you know, I kept hearing from all these supporters of Clyburn that they could not believe he was doing this. They thought he was hugely risking giving free ammunition to critics, folks within the Democratic Party, as well as, you know, the National Republican Campaign Committee immediately came out slamming him for appearing alongside Archie Parnell. And there were Democrats who were saying, you know, this is going to hurt him. I talked to a Democratic member of Congress who said, I have no idea why he would take this kind of risk at this point, this key moment in his career.
Well, and do you think a lot of those people, too, were just, like, just now maybe hearing about that and then putting one-on-one together and be like, oh, my gosh, are you sure you want to roll the dice with that situation?
And, I mean, I would also add, I don't want to go into this, but, you know, he had some critics about how he handled the John Conyers situation, who was a congressman from Michigan who had some allegations against him, and he kind of defended him, and there were some critics there. Anyway, so I caught up with Congressman Clyburn at a press conference yesterday mm-hmm. morning, which was, you were taping this on Thursday, yeah, so Wednesday. It was a Wednesday yeah. morning, and I asked him, you know, what can you explain a little more about what's going on here? And he said, yes, let me explain. This is not me re-endorsing Archie Parnell. I wasn't even invited by Archie Parnell to this event. I haven't spoken to Archie Parnell. I was invited by young Democratic volunteers in Sumter County, my hometown, where he was born, and is part of his district. And, you know, they've gone through this very unpleasant experience in this campaign, and I wanted to thank them and tell them not to be discouraged by, you know, what has been a difficult race and to stay engaged. So, you know, I wrote a story about the fact that he had said that, and the fact that I was hearing from members of Congress and from allies of Congressman Clyburn that thought he was, just by appearing there, even at the same event, even if he was yeah. not re-endorsing
at which,
him, that it would damage
saying, yeah.
his chances. So, you know, and then about 2 hours after I wrote that story, Congressman Clyburn tweeted that he would no longer attend the event. He said, in view of the misrepresentations of why I was going, I will no longer attend. And he emphasized that he is no longer endorsing, or he's still not re-endorsing Archie Parnell. Mm-hmm. You know, who exactly misrepresented what? I can't tell you, because I don't know which side was.
And it seems like a race that they just want to kind of be done with at this
yes.
point.
Yes.
I think they're very ready for November 6th.
There was a lot
6th.
Of potential there, but at the same time, I mean, you stumble
and,
so hard
and I
like
think
that
it's important
and not
to mention
that kind
here,
of
you know, Democrats really, 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 really do not like Congressman Ralph Norman, who is the incumbent in that district. A couple other stories I've written about him in the last few months alone. He pulled out a gun during a meeting with constituents mm-hmm. who were making arguments about gun control. He pulled out his gun, his handgun, from his jacket and put it on the table and left it there for several minutes to make a case that guns are only dangerous in the hands of criminals.
And then he made a joke about Ruth Bader Ginsburg.
And then
Abraham
he made a
Lincoln,
joke about Ruth Bader Ginsburg
so
being groped
it would have been
by
more
Abraham
of a competitive
during the
race
Kavanaugh hearing.
They
really, really don't yeah. like him. Yeah. And so it's been a very unpleasant it race for a lot of folks in that district. Mm-hmm. And this was really icing on the cake, I guess you would say. And
it's been a little bit confusing to try to follow.
Yes.
Just a little.
Very confusing.
But it's Tuesday. It's election day. So draw your own conclusion. I want to get out of this really quick. I know, but I want to point out to one little fact here, and I'm going to talk to Meg about this. The Winthrop poll that came out, we keep referencing. Senator Lindsey Graham was the big takeaway, the big winner, it seems like, in that poll, because he had a huge bump among Republicans, like a 21% bump from April of this year to just now in this poll of approval ratings. So Scott Huffman attributed a lot of that to his defense of Judge Brett Kavanaugh during those confirmation hearings, now Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh. Do you think that Lindsey Graham wishes his primary, or his election was actually this Tuesday instead of 2020?
That's a good point.
I feel like Lindsey Graham is probably feeling pretty good and certainly would wish that some of that could carry into an election of his own. You're right, he's not up until 2 years from now for his re-election bid. But yes, we have seen Lindsey Graham everywhere. It started yeah. during the Kavanaugh hearings. He made a very impassioned defense of Judge Kavanaugh, which has been repeated ad nauseum on social media and other places. And, you know, Lindsey Graham has not always been a darling of the Republican Party. He has been very popular here in South Carolina. He has won election and re-election. But he hasn't been somebody writ large that the RNC was going to send out to be an emissary of their party to campaign in other places. After Kavanaugh, after he really just got people's attention in mm-hmm. a different kind of way, they gave him an itinerary. They said, here's 12 states, 12 days, 12 different places for you to campaign, including for Katie Arrington in Charleston. And they put him to work. So, yes, Lindsey Graham is riding high. And I think that there are a lot of folks who are thinking probably about challenging him in 2020, who are probably still thinking about challenging him in 2020. But they're probably going to have to be rethinking some of those things because they can't go at Lindsey Graham from the, oh, well, he's too moderate or he works too well with Democrats, which is a lot of the criticism that we hear about him from time to time. Right. Now he's on the other side of things, politically speaking, mm-hmm. and I think that there are a lot of folks who may have to kind of rethink how to go about it.
Lee Bright, I mean, Lee Bright came out and gave him a shout out.
So, yeah, I wrote a story the day after the Kavanaugh hearings, and I called up, you know, a lot of the folks who I've heard for several years just absolutely, you know, destroy Lindsey Graham verbally for several years.
He gets
Lee Bright, who ran
right
against him in 2014. You know, I called up Presley Stutz, who's the Greenville Tea Party chairman. I called up, you know, a bunch of folks who, you know, are just huge, huge critics of Senator Graham from the right. And they were in love. I mean, it was just like they couldn't believe what they had seen.
We had a whole podcast dedicated to
It was remarkable. And I think that the Winthrop poll, what we saw with Senator Graham's popularity surging, was very representative of that sentiment we are hearing. Of course, it should be said that he may have now avoided a primary challenge. He is only going to incite more of a general election challenge. You know, we've already heard from Jamie Harrison, the former South Carolina Democratic Party chairman, now works at the DNC. He's been pretty open about the fact that he is strongly, strongly considering running. Wouldn't be surprised if we see other folks come out of the woodwork. Look, again, obviously, as we've said, South Carolina is a historically red state. Senator Lindsey Graham has a political machine behind him.
Oh, survived his
but,
huge primary.
You know, I think he has. We'll see if anyone comes out to run against him. I think some of his strongest contenders are now going to look away. John Warren, who ran against Governor McMaster in the Republican primary this year, had been talked about one. He had been seen as a potentially strong contender. We'll see, but from what I have heard, it seems increasingly less likely that that's going to happen in the wake of Kavanaugh.
And Senator Graham is already capitalizing on some of that. You guys probably
absolutely
noticed.
Absolutely.
Well,
hard.
And also his email generation is already kicked into high gear.
Yeah.
Scott Farmer, who's headed up a lot of his political stuff for the past couple of cycles and who is also working with Governor McMaster right now, Scott sent out an email from his Lindsey Graham email account a couple of weeks ago. Only nerds like me would really dig down and notice that. But that just shows you right there, 2020 is already here. Well, We've seen it from the presidential side, and here too. Yeah,
one of his emails said, "They're coming." You know, that was the subject line. We talked about that, and it was...
You know, I talk about back to your team
during election day.
And I talk about him inciting, you know, the other side. The South Carolina Democratic Party has been already fundraising for the 2020 campaign against Lindsey Graham. Frankly, I have heard from some Democratic congressional candidates who are running this time who would say, I kind of like them to focus on this election.
Yeah, exactly.
With that being said. Skipping ahead.
But, you know, he generates a lot of passion on both sides, and passion brings out wallets.
Exactly. So. Well, and that being said, that's kind of referring to, it is election day if you're listening to this on Tuesday. We're already previewing 2020, but let's find out what happens today on election day and this week. We're going to, again, have Meg and Jamie. Hopefully, we're all going to be in the same place Tuesday election night that we can cut a podcast for Wednesday to drop. And again, South Carolina ETV will also be hosting live election night coverage for 2 hours from 8 p.m. to 10 p.m. And it will be also streamed on South Carolina Public Radio as well. So I'll be out in the field. We'll have people out in the studio and also in Charleston and with the Democrats and Republicans. So we'll have you covered for 2 straight hours. But I want to give a special thanks to the Associated Press's Meg Kennard and the Post and Courier's Jamie Lovegrove for joining us today. Guys, thank you so much.
Sure. Happy to be here.
Thank you, Gavin. Thank you, everybody.
So in our final section, Did You Know?, we focus on one quirky function of the state, politics, or government. It's named after the parliamentary procedure lawmakers use when speaking to each other. Now, did you know that South Carolina Public Radio's Russ McKinney, who is a Spartanburg native... Where'd that cake? Calm down out there. Is sitting in front of me right now in front of a huge crowd of great people who came out to support us, and he has some great state trivia for us. Russ, welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So what we're going to do is Russ is going to ask one of his easy questions, and we're going to all raise our hands after he asks it again and try and see maybe what the possible answer is, because I'm pretty notorious at this for getting them wrong. So let's, and I told Russ to give us some Greenville upstate specific questions, so there's even more of a wager for you all to do well on this. So Russ, take it away. Let's see what you got.
This is a great crowd. Thanks everybody for coming. This is kind of the fun part of the podcast where take advantage of Gavin. He's not a native South Carolinian.
Everyone gets up and leaves.
So when we ask him questions about Frogmore Stew and who was the 14th governor of South Carolina, he sometimes has a little trouble. But he's a quick study, and he does well. And
he's a good sport.
Yeah, and he's a very good sport, and we have fun.
Even more today with the spirit.
I'm the one intimidated tonight. I had no idea this was going to be a great audience. So you guys know a lot more about these questions I'm getting ready to ask than I do. So please jump in and help him. But we'll start with a real easy one.
That's what he always says. Don't buy it.
This one will be. The first recorded civil rights demonstration march in South Carolina occurred in 1960. In what city did it occur in?
I'm going to guess it's... He's gonna list them off, and then we'll raise our hands. Hey!
Okay, and I said they'd be easy. A, Greenville. B, Orangeburg. C, Rock Hill. D, Manning.
Now, to be clear, I did tell Russ to come up with upstate-based questions, so there's a little of an advantage right there. So, okay, Russ is going to say them again, and we're all going to raise our hands. I'm going to raise mine last after I see how many people raise their hands. And we're going to raise our hands to see what the answer might be. So, Russ, let's go through those again. And if you think you know the answer, feel free to raise your hand. Don't shout out, but just raise your hand.
Okay, A, Greenville. I think I might have got them out of order for my list. B, Orangeburg. C, Rock Hill.
I'm going to go Rock Hill because I think...
D, Manning, as in Clarendon County.
Meg, what do you think?
I'm going to go with Orangeburg.
Jamie, what are you saying?
I feel like, obviously, the conventional wisdom is Orangeburg, but that, I think that may be leading to some kind of trick question.
See, welcome to my world.
I'm going to go with Manning.
Oh, my God. Well, I'm going to go with Rock Hill because I am feeling pretty
John
confident
John Land Country.
That.
This is peak
And I
Russ
swear to God,
McKinley
if I win
right
in front of everyone, this is not a stage setup. Okay, Russ, what's the answer?
The answer is A, Greenville.
Again, it's an upstate-based question.
On New Year's Day, 1960, demonstrators marched from downtown Greenville to the Greenville Airport, now the Greenville Downtown Airport, and they were protesting the segregated waiting room at the Greenville Airport. Baseball all-star or great Jackie Robinson had been denied access to that waiting room some weeks earlier. And that was the first recorded civil rights demonstration in the state. The following month, in February, was the sit-in at the lunch counter in Rock Hill that gets a lot of attention.
Indeed.
Interesting. Well, Russ, thank you very much for that question.
Can I leave?
And applause to everyone who won that. I didn't get it, but, you know, got to keep that streak alive. Thank you, Russ.
Okay.
We can't thank Greenville enough for accommodating us during our first live taping. Again, a special thanks to Growler House who hosted us, the SCETV Endowment, our guests, and everyone who showed up. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Also, be sure to keep an eye out, or an ear, I should say, for Wednesday's mini-pod on the election results, and keep up with our social media as we expect to drop future live taping event dates very shortly. The South Carolina Lead is one of many ways SCETV wants to help keep you informed. Check out the latest news and live streams on scetv.org. Listen to the coverage from South Carolina Public Radio and watch This Week in South Carolina, a show where I talk with the newsmakers of the week on SCETV every Friday at 7:30 p.m. and Sunday at 11:30 a.m. All of that, this podcast, and more is available on SCETV's super easy-to-use app and scpublicradio.org. Subscribe to us, and we'll have a new episode for you every Tuesday on Apple Podcasts. Search us easily on your Android, the NPR One app, or wherever you find podcasts. Follow us on Instagram at @scleadpod, where you can see photos from the studio, on assignment, and of course, our sweet memes. We're also on Twitter with the same handle at @scleadepod. We have swag, sticker swag that is. Send us a direct message or slide into our DMs, as we say, on Twitter or Instagram with your address, and we'll send one your way. Email questions, comments, or your gripes to scleade@scetv.org. The South Carolina Lead is produced in partnership with South Carolina ETV, South Carolina Public Radio, and a special thanks to the Post and Courier and the Associated Press. Our producer is A.T. Shire. Sean Birch is our supervising producer. Caitlin Park is our social media consultant. Tom Posey is our executive producer. This episode was recorded at Growler House in Greenville on November 1st, 2018. I'm Gavin Jackson. Thanks for listening.
Secret message. Russ McKinney is my spirit animal.